It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
All right, boys and girls, we are back with another edition of the Ben Domenech podcast brought to you by Fox News. You can check out all of our podcasts at foxnewspodcast.com. I hope you will rate, review, and subscribe to this one and recommend it to your friends if you think that it is worth their time. Today, I have a conversation for this Memorial Day on the sacrifice that is a part of any Memorial Day focused families. And that's from Michelle Black, and the author of Sacrifice, The Green Berets, A Fateful Ambush, and A Gold Star Widow's Fight for the Truth. Michelle is the wife of a fallen hero for America. You may recall the incident that led to his death in Niger, one that actually surprised a number of people in Washington who ought to have known that we had troops in harm's way and somehow didn't. Michelle Black joins me for a conversation about that and how she confronts a Memorial Day where her children are without their father. Michelle Black, coming up next.
Jason in the House, the Jason Chaffetz Podcast. Dive deeper than the headlines and the party lines as I take on American life, politics, and entertainment. Subscribe now on foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Michelle, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
Thank you for having me on.
I am familiar with your story, both from your book and from your appearance on the Mic Drop podcast about 9 or 10 months ago, which was very moving in a lot of different ways. I don't want you to have to go through the experience of summarizing, everything related to your book. But I will say that, you know, from my perspective, as someone who was unfamiliar with the missions of a lot of people within the Africa environment. My brother has been there twice, at least, I think maybe three times now, in terms of his tours. What did it feel like sending your husband to a place that a lot of Americans don't view as being an ever-present combat environment, a war that the nation is aware of?
Well, I think our mentality is a little different than even regular Army, being that he was a Green Beret and special operator on an ODA, which is an operational detachment alpha team. So their mission sets are really quite different. That's why Green Berets are called warrior diplomats. And they often say they're first in, last out. And so a lot of times they're just sent there to train the local troops to protect against the growing threat of violent extremism in an area. And so usually what they're going into is a situation where it's growing, but it's not a huge threat yet to our men on the ground. So for me, Brian being in Niger, Africa, wasn't something where I considered him in a combat zone, because it wasn't officially a combat zone, and it wasn't dangerous. What happened to him and his team was really unusual, and it was the first time since it was the largest loss of American life on that continent since Black Hawk Down, which was in 1993, or also known as the Battle of Mogadishu. So sending him there, I was very comfortable.
You know, it's one of these weird things that is a tension that erupts into national discourse. I am someone who has a fairly, I would say, traditional conservative aspect toward involvement overseas. what that means from my perspective is that I'm fine with massive troop deployments when it comes to the Korean Peninsula or Germany or you know, places around the world. We can dispute, you know, the Iraqi, you know, project or the Afghanistan project. But the point is, I'm not designed to like pull people back. Lindsey Graham, who's someone who I've had the occasion to meet and talk to, seems surprised that there were even troops in Niger. What was your reaction to seeing the fact that it really felt like Washington, D.C. didn't know that this was even going on?
It tells me that they are sleeping through their briefs. SOC Africa, and in fact, the general, the former general of SOC Africa told me that he briefed them just that summer on operations in Africa. So it makes me question whether or not they are paying attention, really, during some of these briefs where military leaders come in and tell them where we're at and what we're doing. I mean, that's how we get our funding to these troops on the ground for AFRICOM. So all of this has to kind of be brought by Congress, from what I understand. And so when they began to say that, I wondered, were they really unaware? Did they miss that briefing by the SOC Africa commander? Or is this just a way that they're politicizing this incident? I really didn't know.
Were they sleeping through the previous night's fundraiser, or were they more more attentive at that point? Look, the experience that you went through is one that very few Americans would ever have the occasion to understand. We live in an era in which the military environment has been shifted to a lot of different populations in America. It doesn't have the kind of widespread involvement that it used to. When you tried to talk about your experience to people who don't even know anybody who's serving in the military, don't even know anybody whose husband is serving in the military, how do you try to describe it?
Well, it's interesting because I was raised about as far from the military as a person could be. My first experience with the military was when Brian joined. His dad was the first military member I met, and I was 27 at the time when I met him. So, and Brian didn't join until I was 30 years old. So for me, it's a little easier because I relate to civilians who have no experience. In fact, that's why I think my book has had such an impact on civilian populations. I read it with my mom and my sister in mind, and I wanted them to be able to relate to what I went through, starting with just living a normal civilian life and Brian joining after we were already married. So to relate the incident, I think it's like anything. It's like any loss. And there are plenty of people, especially after COVID, who have lost people. So it's that same experience of loss, just because it was such, it became national news and was blown up. It was just a much bigger, just high visibility. But I really think people relate if they've been through any sort of loss, they can relate to the loss of a military member.
There's a generational change here where, you know, for wives, mothers, and children and the like, who experienced a loved one being lost in the Second World War, for instance, they got a letter. They had someone come to their door. They didn't have to deal with the follow-on media coverage. The propagandistic release of America's enemies in order to try to prove a point. You had to deal with all of that. What was the experience like for you in that? And what lessons would you apply for those who are mothers and, you know, spouses, you know, the children of people who have to go into harm's way about the necessary lessons to take away from the social media experience that comes from these types of events now?
I'm going to say, first off, I think one huge lesson that needs to be applied on a whole is that social media adds a whole new complexity to everything. And so when we take, like, for instance, what happened to Brian, where there was an ISIS propaganda video released of his death, when that gets shared even as news, in the end, everybody screen grabs that. And for the rest of my life and for the rest of my children's lives and the children of the other men who were killed and in that video, that video of their father's death is out there. And every time we turn on social media, it's there. So I think a huge takeaway should be to those in our country who are considering, hey, I've got a tape here and it is news, but is showing someone's death worth the torment and the trauma and the true terror that it causes the family? In Brian's case, and I think, it was very unique in that not only was it a huge national news story and there was an investigation that quickly opened, but there were just multiple injustices that were piling up because the team began to be blamed. And then this ISIS propaganda video was released as news. But in the end, it was a terrorist video used to terrorize the family. And unfortunately, even as news, that terrorizes us and further impacts us and the trauma we've gone through. And so I think before we begin to push these things out, we really need to consider the effects on the families long term and not the adults. There are kids involved. Mm-hmm.
In terms of my experience with this kind of thing, it does seem to run rampant, and there is a natural media interest in a news-focused story where they want to report on this, and there's video or there's material that's out there that goes to their story. How do you believe that ought to be adjudicated? Do you believe that this is a situation where, you know, we should just, you know, rely on these news entities to prevent the spread of you know, material that basically doesn't serve any purpose, you know, in terms of, you know, beheading videos or things that are, you know, absolutely terrible and triggering for the families involved, where you could just report that, you know, Daniel Pearl was murdered and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think that with videos like this, especially, you know, when you see, I mean, with this specific instance, I mean, you see my husband being shot, you see him go down being drugged through the dirt, you see, you know, the other two men being shot multiple times, the blood, the screams. I mean, it's horrible stuff. And I don't understand why we can't have something put in place where you need the permission of the families to sign off on showing any portion of this. Mm-hmm. I understand it for training the troops. I understand it for lessons learned within the military. But as far as the public, it's at that point, it's not news. It's just terror.
You told a story that I feel like is very accurate about your interaction with President Trump on this that was then repeated to, you know, another surviving family. I felt like that was an honest depiction of your own opinion, but also the opinion, I believe, of a lot of American families who send their sons and daughters off to fight for the country. In terms of the tension that you may feel about that, is this something that you've resolved within yourself, that you've said something that was true and honest, that was coming from your own heart, regardless of the media clash that happened afterwards?
Yes. The only thing that I regretted with my words was that they may have been repeated, but I can't, you know, that onus isn't on me. That's not my responsibility.
No.
I did state that, you know, this Brian signed up for this. This was a possibility. We knew that we're adults. And it, of course, it's still painful. But, you know, I appreciated Trump calling and giving his condolences. And unfortunately, you know, his next phone call, he repeated my words. But yeah, I'm still glad that I said what I said, because it was the truth. And in that moment, it's what I felt. And it's what I still feel. Brian signed up. And it's just part of it's part of the deal. When you sign up for the military, it's always a possibility that you lose your life. You're fighting for freedom. You're fighting for your country. So.
How do your kids deal with Memorial Day?
Well, they're actually, they do really well. They are part of a group, an organization called Wear Blue, Run to Remember. And it's really great. They have flags with their dad's name, and they join military mentors, pair up with them, and run every weekend building up for the 2 months building up to Memorial Day. And then they go out there, and there's pictures of their dad out along the trail. And they really have a good time remembering their dad. And then we spend time with their grandparents and, you know, just share memories of their dad and pictures of him. And it's really good. They do well, very well.
We live in a time in America where a much lower percentage of Americans serve in the military. It has shrunk significantly and is increasingly something that is kind of a social sort, where in the past you might have a significant portion of the military be from states like New York and California. It is increasingly from states like Texas and Florida. When it comes to espousing the virtues of serving in the American military, what can we do to change people's minds about the way that they approach this, to sort of say, this is something that ought to unite us as a country, as opposed to be something that is, you know, basically part of our political environment, where if you're from a red state, you're a lot more likely to serve. And if you're from a blue state, then you don't even, you know, have to deal with this idea. You know, you end up being like Gabe Kapler, the San Francisco Giants, saying, oops, I guess I should have saved that. I'm not going to go out there for the flag thing until after Memorial Day.
Well, you know, I think that's a really interesting, question. It's interesting because when I, you know, when Brian was serving and afterwards, as I began interviewing his team for the book, I began to realize what a mix the men were, as far as anything from Democrat to Republican to Libertarian and, you know, just all sorts. But together they worked. It's one of the few places in America within the military you see everybody from every background working together as a unified force, and they all get along and they all love each other and they treat each other like brothers and sisters. And it's like stepping back, you know, back to the 80s, where it didn't matter what your political leanings were.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody just respects each other and has each other's backs, and there's a lot of love there. And I wish our society could see that side. And I think a lot of what drives our society's interpretation of the military is what they see on TV and what they see in the news. And unfortunately, a lot of those are huge misconceptions. You know, that we have these misconceptions that the military men are dumb, or that they are, you know, army wives are, you know, just straight out, they sit around and gossip all day. And, you know, I have to say, some of the most intelligent people I have ever met, I met through the military. I mean, my husband was a national chess champion. He spoke four languages. And that was pretty standard for the men serving in special forces. They were incredibly intelligent. you know, he was creating a trading algorithm right before he was killed, a stock trading algorithm. So, I mean, these men are no joke, and, you know, had worked in hospitals, was an 18 Delta. So he was a medical sergeant and had been trained almost to the level of a PA and could treat gunshot victims and deliver babies and horses. He had experience with vet medicine as well as, you know, regular medicine. And so I think a lot of our misinterpretations come from TV. And so I hope that more Americans will read books like mine and see the reality and really the human element behind our armed forces.
Michelle, I want to ask you about that kind of, you know, assumptions that are built in culturally. You know, one of the things that I've been very aware of in the last couple of years, I think maybe it exploded during the pandemic, is this idea of American masculinity as being this kind of CrossFit combo kind of thing, you know, just like it's the size of your muscles. It's the, you know, the way that you approach life in that kind of vein versus people who I thought of as being emblematic of American masculinity, meaning men who had kind of a tragic view of life, that you could, in the words of Victor Davis Hanson, be perfect without being good. And that's one of the things that I view as being a very admirable approach to life, which is to say, you don't need to not mess up. You need to have the right goals in mind. And that, you know, translates to the way that we live our lives as husbands and fathers, the way that we try to learn things in order to teach things. What are the things that we can take from a military life, a military approach to life that your husband took that we ought to apply to learn about the proper nature of American manhood, as opposed to, you know, maybe the depiction that is prepared for us on TV?
Yeah, it's funny because I think the version that you see on TV and you see on social media a lot of times, it's funny, I hear the word savage a lot. And
yeah, no, that's a good one. Yeah.
I've discussed that a lot with some of the Green Berets and they crack up because they say, no, we've seen savage. We've been around that, you know, the true definition of that word in the countries we've been in. And what I've noticed with these men and how I really view masculinity is these are men who could, most of them, like Brian, skilled in hand-to-hand combat, you know, did a lot of cage fighting, jiu-jitsu, could kill most people just with their bare hands pretty quickly. But honestly, would never want to. They're kind, patient, extremely humble. And no matter how intelligent they are, they're always under the impression that they aren't the intelligent, the most intelligent person in the room. And they're there to serve. That's a man. Being a servant, working hard, and being humble. And that's what I take away from my different interactions with multiple Green Berets, a bunch of gentle, extremely intelligent giants.
How do you cope with a day like this when so many people are remembering their loved ones, their family members, their husbands, their fathers? How do you cope with it and not just despair?
I try to remember the good things. You know, there's so much good that Brian left behind. And in the aftermath, I see all the good that has happened in my life and my kids' life, you know, and I think that's one big thing when he first passed away was just having to remind myself of different things I'd hear, you know, different things from the Bible, different Bible verses that, you know, there will be good days again. you know, God knows the number, you know, the number mm-hmm. of hairs on your head. And, you know, he has good plans for you, even after horrible things happen, you know. So on days like this, I try and hold tight to all the promises of God and joining together with other families who are in similar situations. That's part of why we got involved in the Wear Blue thing, in the Wear Blue organization, is because I go there, my kids run with other Gold Star kids, and I hang out with Gold Star widows, and we can just kind of have that community and be supported by all the veterans around us and active duty soldiers, and our families come on those days.
Let's close out on this. I don't mean to intrude into your own personal life, but what happens that makes you feel his presence in your life still?
It's always my kids. I see them and I know he's just so proud, not only of the job I've done with them, but of the men they're becoming. That's, I'm going to lose it, but no, that's when I feel him. Yeah.
You can feel it there.
Yeah. Yeah. They're his spitting image. Ezekiel mm-hmm. is his same height, his same build, and talks and walks just like him. So, you know, sometimes that catches me off guard.
But, yeah. Yeah. You can feel it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Michelle, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
Thank you for having me on.
So I wanted to suggest to you that if you have the time, you ought to check out a number of things this Memorial Day that might be beneficial to you. There are a number of different organizations out there that are doing great work when it comes to reaching out to veterans' families and the lives that have been affected by those who lost their lives in service of the country. Travis Mannion Foundation is one of those. It's one that's endorsed by both my sister, Emily Dominich, and by Mary Catherine Hamm, among others, people who might be familiar to you if you are Fox viewers. And I would also encourage you to simply reach out to those in your community who may have been experiencing memories and disconnect from those that they lost in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, wars that obviously affected innumerable American people with the loss of husbands, fathers, sons, and others. And I also wanted to encourage you to check out a speech. I published this on The Transom, my newsletter on Substack, which you can find at thetransom.com, a speech from 2012 by John Kelly, who at the time was a lieutenant general. He had not yet ascended to being chief of staff for President Trump. He is obviously a Gold Star father, someone who lost his son in Afghanistan. And he gave some incredible remarks about the nature of loss, the nature of being separated from your son and everything that that means. From my perspective, this is a very difficult thing to handle when it comes to conflicts that are not at the center of America's experience. It's one thing to lose a family member, you know, a son, a father, etc., when the conflict is at the center of the American cultural moment, something that everyone is aware of as a citizen. Unfortunately, we now live in an environment where we have so many little small conflicts that people do not have that level of awareness. We are unfortunately on the cusp of potentially, you know, major conflicts, ones that will involve a number of American soldiers, just, you know, in various different ways, potentially in Taiwan, you know, potentially, you know, going up against Chinese influence across the South Pacific. That's something that I think would be a real shock to the system for an America that has become very familiar with small wars all over the place, you know, a handful of people dying here and there in Africa or in parts of Asia, places that we may not even have known that we were involved, compared to potentially a major conflict, one that would actually involve multiple world powers taking each other on. Personally, I hope that's something that can be avoided, that can be deterred, that can be balanced against by American investment and by wise strategy coming from the top. Unfortunately, I don't think that is much in the offing at the moment. I'm Ben Domenech. You've been listening to another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast. We will be back soon with more to dive back into the fray.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.